Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 219, Buddha's Joy, Exploring Buddhist Tantra.
First of all, Lama Tsongkhapa studied with Kadampa teacher, Sakyapa teachers, Kagyupa teachers, and Nyingmapa teachers. And then within Kagyu, there are many different varieties in that time. And he had strongest relationship with the Drigung Kagyu and the Drukpa Kagyu. And he had a sense of connection to Atisha and Dromdomba, who were the founders of the Kadampa school in the 11th century. So the renewed school at first, they didn't call Gelugpa. They called it Gandenba, because that was the name of the monastery that had to be built because he had so many students, so they had to build a monastery. But he was not into making some exclusive thing. In other words, it wasn't a big this versus that versus the other. He was into serving the need of the people. His main patron was a Kagyu teacher, actually, the Pagmo Druba, they were called, and also some Sakyapas were his main teacher. One of his main teachers was Sakyapa, but his main patron was a Kagyu. And when he first had funding to do some things, he didn't actually build his monastery. He went to Lhasa, and he spent all the money on a big festival. He hired artists to renew all the murals and the statues and the paintings in the Jokang, the central cathedral of Lhasa, and the Ramoche, and all the different temples and holy plots in Lhasa. And then he organized a festival for 2 weeks at the New Year, the Lunar New Year, celebrating Shakyamuni's time of triumphal teaching and Shravasti, you know, which then became the Munlam Chemo festival that was happened for the next 500 years, you know, and in 1409. And then only after that, then the patrons insisted that they expand the monastery where he lived, the retreat place, and then they made Ganden Monastery. And I think Ganden, the name Ganden is a very significant name, because Ganden is the heaven where Maitreya Buddha is currently dwelling, the Tushita heaven, and it's where he, Shakyamuni, came from on his way to planet Earth, you know, to in the thousands of years, or 2,000 years earlier. And there was a prophecy that around Tsongkhapa's time, that the Dharma was kind of finished, that it was kind of all over with, which periodically happens in Buddhism, but there were these 400 or 500 year periods, and it's about 2,000 years after Shakyamuni's time. So I think Tsongkhapa was feeling that he needed to do some big effort to try to renew the energy in Tibet of the Dharma in all the schools, not just in some one particular new school, but all of them. And actually the one he picked was the one that had no political power at all, the Kadampa one, because it was, although it was the oldest, you know, of the post-second diffusion schools, Kadampa, from Atisha, it had no political patronage particularly, you know, Kadampa. But all of them, actually, the Kagyu curriculum, the Sakya curriculum, the Nyingma curriculum, were very influenced by the Kadampa, actually. So that's one thing. Then you say the most particular characteristic, I would say, is embodied in our Blessed Holiness, the Dalai Lama, may he live another 100 aeons. And let me tell you what that is. When Tsongkhapa attained enlightenment in 1398, there's a tradition that he got really clear about emptiness, you know, the way they put it. But he was also doing Tantra simultaneously, especially Guhyasamaja. And he would, and he, because he considers Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti not only the great Madhyamaka teacher, but also great Tantra teacher. So they were the same person as far as Tibetans go, and as far as I go, and not according to modern scholars. But they are the same person. And he said this strange thing. First he wrote that poem that we read here, that we were blessed with. And then second, he said it was the opposite of what he expected. And he was already, he was 41 years of age, and he'd been studying since he was 3. And he was like a child prodigy. He was a really brilliant type. And yet, and so he had all definitions of enlightenment. And then he said it was opposite of what he expected. And what can that mean? And I don't know. I really don't know. I don't pretend to. But I have a theory, which I'll share. Remember I said a Buddha, when you become a Buddha, you think you're everybody. You follow? So that means that you suddenly, instead of being located inside your skin alone, looking out, listening, thinking your own thoughts with your own inner place, you suddenly physically and mentally feel you're everybody. So suddenly you see the world from infinite different facets and points of view. So in other words, you might have thought, however you read it about it being defined, you might have thought, wow, I'm going to feel really great. And you do, but simultaneously you feel everybody else's feeling. And some of them don't feel so great. A lot of them are actually freaking out. And you're totally aware of that. So your compassion is completely also expanded, which is a sensitivity to suffering of others, as well as your wisdom and bliss. Okay? So this is really key. And I will tell an anecdote. When I finally had a glimpse of this in the person of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Thank you. I was in Switzerland visiting him because he was doing a big teaching in a big, huge room like this. I think even bigger than this. And a lot of people. And he was on the throne and teaching maybe 10 years ago. I forget exactly. And I had business. I had to meet with him about Tibet House and some practical matter. So I wasn't able to be there at the teaching because I had to go work and all this, you know, wasn't free. But I got to sneak into one teaching. And I got to sit on the back of the stage, you know, with all the lamas and the different people from, you know how it is when His Holiness does a big teaching. And he taught that verse about the goldsmith that I'm sure he's taught all of you. You know, where he says, you know, Buddha says monks and wise people, They don't just accept what the teacher says. They're like a goldsmith who measures the gold and melts the gold and cuts it and rubs it on a touchstone and then buys it, then accepts it. And then you have to examine whatever I say and think about it and see how it works with your reason and your experience. And then if it's worthwhile, you accept it as gold. And you don't just do it out of devotion to the teacher. You remember that? He teaches that all the time, that one, that verse. And as he was teaching, he was leaning forward like this. It's just like a waiter in a restaurant. You know, someone who brings you the menu, like, what do you want, you know? He was leaning like that. And he was saying, I can even imagine Shakyamuni, he said, begging his students, don't just, oh, Buddha said so. Don't just do that. Use your own mind and really make it your own and reject it if you don't. You know, His Holiness often will say at the end of a teaching, if it's not suit your mind, just forget about it. Bob, slightly slower. Oh, I'm sorry. So in other words, I think Tsongkhapa had the experience, like His Holiness, if I might be so bold to imagine, because I don't know for sure, to realize that the teacher is the servant of the student, not the boss of the student, not the master, doesn't go around with the idea, I'm better than the student. That's in India, in Buddha's time and still today, it's a kind of authoritarian, patriarchal society. And in the family, the father is the patriarch, you know, and the big boss. And the guru, in Sanskrit, guru means heavy. It actually literally means heavy, like a heavy weight. And so the idea is a heavy thing on your head, like authority. But the model of teacher in Buddhism is Kalyana Mitra, friend, a good friend, virtuous friend. Yes, in the initiation, you have this thing about the Buddha comes through the teacher, and then you have to see the Buddha in the teacher, etc., at a very esoteric, advanced level. But the main model for the teacher is a friend, not your boss, but someone who's like your better angel, your conscience, who says, hey, come on, don't be an idiot, you know, like a friend does, right? But not somehow bossing you, because you have to do yourself, your understanding. So Tsongkhapa, you know, the root of his teaching and why it spread so strongly in Tibet for the next 200 years without any political backing, particularly. In fact, against some other people who were politically like upset by so many people building so many monasteries, having and all the country demilitarizing basically, and the aristocrats losing their power and their private armies. It's what happened gradually. So he realized that the teacher is there for the sake of the student. The teacher is not the master of all the students. And that's a kind of challenging. When I listened to His Holiness say that, I was looking past at some of the other lamas and teachers, and also not Buddhists, you know, various yogis and, you know, every kind of teacher, some Christian monks and some rabbis, and, you know, usual big audience, you know. And they looked a little nervous, because here is he's sitting on throne, you know, in the Tibetan initiatory sense, but he was teaching Shantideva, you know. And he was showing himself by body language and by the meaning as a servant of the students. And the students' understanding is what's important here. Not that I'm such a great thing, but they are the great thing. And I think that was the essential characteristic of Tsongkhapa's tradition and why it spread so widely in Tibet. And why the other schools, actually, I don't like the word sect, by the way. I think it's inappropriate for Tibet. I think orders or schools is better, you know, because sect is a word that comes from, in English, from Protestant history, where they're very violently fighting each other all the time. And Tibet is not that bad, actually. It's not perfect, but it's not that bad. And they all look to Shakyamuni Buddha. They all have the same path, you know, they all have tantras. Many of them are same tantras. Avalokiteshvara is different than Jesus, you know, there's only one Jesus. But Avalokiteshvara has many, many saviors, you know. There's no limit to the number of saviors in the Buddhist worldview, not just one. So the tendency is not as rigid a difference. But I think the people who later got a little freaked out about Tsongkhapa were people who, they wanted to be higher than the student. There's two kinds of experience of oneness. Let me just say this to make it more clear. There is an experience where it seems like the whole universe is one thing, meditative experience, and nobody is there. It's called the formless realm state, infinite space. Shakyamuni even taught that experience. The infinite space realm, infinite consciousness realm, even the nothingness realm, and then something beyond consciousness and nothingness, something like that. There's four formless states. And when you achieve those states, they say, you feel like that's what the whole universe is. And there's nothing there. And you don't feel selfish and guilty because you don't think you're there, but although you are. Your consciousness fills the whole thing. But you're not there like a separated person. But nobody else is there. But Buddha very carefully said, even in individual vehicle Buddhism, that's not nirvana. It's just a state. It's a state of oneness with no specific thing in it. And that's not nirvana. It's a formless realm. And if you think it's nirvana, you become a deity of formless realm and you're trapped there for a long period of time. So I call it the cheap oneness. The expensive oneness, on the other hand, is where you come back from such an attainment and then somehow you unify the feeling of emptiness of infinite space with all the other people. So that then suddenly you feel we're all one and everybody else is here with all their problems. And therefore compassion is there with all of them and we have to keep at it. We didn't just disappear into some separate place. The fantasy of the selfish person, actually. That then I went there and I'm higher than other people because they don't know about that and they think they're only here and I know I'm really over there. No, you're not really over there. That's just another state. Where we really are is really here. And when we're really here and we know we're one with everybody here, then we are devoted to all of them. We love them all. So we don't want anyone to be unhappy. We're committed by compassion that they not be unhappy. Whatever, however, which is really complicated how to do that. Right? Really complicated. So I think that's the Tsongkhapa's distinguishing characteristic. The institutions that he founded, and then his first disciple, a younger disciple, wasn't his first disciple then, but it became the Dalai Lama line and the Panchen Lama line, those two disciples. So that's the thing. Teacher is your friend, not your boss, basically. That, I think, is the distinguishing characteristic. And that's His Holiness's great service to us human beings. So amazing he is. May he live forever. Okay, so, well, you know, Buddha, in the Buddhist biography, the first person he met asked him, before he met the five ascetics and talked the Four Noble Truths, he met some guy on the way who actually was a Jain, a kind of a Jain, supposedly, who said, "Well, you look really great. You look fabulous, darling. You look great." So, "Who's your teacher?" And Buddha said, "I am self-originated, Swayambhu. I'm my own teacher," he said to that guy. And then that guy said, "Oh, great. Well, I have another teacher." And the guy left. He didn't even study anything with Buddha. The Buddha was going to teach the other people. So ultimately, of course, even in the tantric initiation, which I think is wrongly translated as empowerment, I don't think that's really a good translation. I think consecration or initiation is much better for abhisheka. The Sanskrit word abhisheka means anointment, you know, to sprinkle with the holy substance, like anointment, abhisheka means. And anyway, even in that one, where you should to receive, visualize that the deity, you know, the Buddha or Chakrasambhara or Vajrayogini or whoever it is, Manjushri, is the teacher. They're the same being. The teacher becomes a vessel. Then you have the idea of a guru or mentor returns. But even that is in order for you to shift your own imagination to practice that you yourself are Manjushri or whatever it is. You know, it isn't just to sit there and worship the teacher. It's like when you see a picture of Shakyamuni, that's a channel for you to remember Shakyamuni and feel the presence. You know that the painting itself is not Shakyamuni. Okay? So
the three times thing is,
you know, it's an illusion. Our sense, when, you know, this idea of being in the present moment is actually where there's no past and no future, is itself an illusion. It's like a line in geometry. It has no width. A split second has no duration. So there's only past and future, actually. So in addition to overcoming some kind of illusion about fixed place in space, enlightenment shatters the fixed illusion of fixed moment of time. And so a Buddha becomes aware of the infinite process of causation. It doesn't cancel causation. The idea that Buddha doesn't care about good and evil is completely wrong. Buddha sees good in everything, actually, is what he sees. But it can turn anything that is negative into the positive. But it's not that they don't exist, the causality. So Buddha's compassion extends into other beings' future to make their journey to their own enlightenment as quick as possible for them. Because why should they needlessly continue to suffer? Buddha feels. But different beings, it's like a gardener. You can't just take a rose, a sprout, and pull it up into a rose bush. It has to grow. But you can maximize and optimize the conditions, you know. So I think this is why His Holiness likes to do Kalachakra so much, the time machine. Because that's showing, there Buddha shows a body that's made of time to encourage people that he has not abandoned them in their future. That he stays with, his compassion stays with them, helping them use time to evolve to their own Kalachakrahood or Buddhahood. Buddha is not, never claims omnipotence, even Vajrapani, you know, power of all Buddhas. But I call it omnicompetence. So knowing the future doesn't mean that it's just a machine that automatically unfolds. Knowing the future means that, which is inconceivable to us, it's like a supercomputer that sees all the options that the beings will face, and the compassion causes manifestations that will help them make the best choices. But that doesn't mean that controls their choices. They still make the choices. But the compassion of the Buddha causes him to manifest whatever it is to make their options most likely that they will choose the best thing. But the problem is, you see, it's a real interesting double-bind paradox. Only yourself can understand your selflessness. If someone tries to force you to selflessness, yourself will consider it an assault and become more rigidly bound into your self-centeredness, if you follow me. So you can only teach someone by getting them to think and to reason and to experience, and then they may come to the best one, and then the best teacher tries the best method. But they don't control what the student will understand. They cannot. Okay? So it's not indoctrination, and it's not mechanical. Okay? Thank you. It's love. It's like love. That's what it is. Compassion and love. Yes. I think everything, every nonviolent movement is going to be successful. That's my personal opinion. And it may take a long time, and many people will die, probably. But they will definitely die in larger numbers with any violence. And the way that the modern consciousness is, you know, with the blessings of technology, the good side of it, where people know everything about everybody else, potentially. Facebook, you know, Internet, Google Earth. We can see that we can count the number of fish in Lake Baikal if we make an effort. And so in this new situation where in a way you have a global information net, now it can be abused, and we see it being abused now, and it can be also colonized in a way. But ultimately, if people know this, I think people will make positive choice. Human beings will. Because especially it has to do with women, in my opinion. And the women in the militaristic history of the planet since Shakyamuni's time, in all, everywhere, is such that the women were always suppressed. Because when you have militarism, the male will be more violent, and then they'll also be militaristic in the family with the wife and the children. And so violence will dominate. But when when information and awareness dominates, and then even the men realize that it's no fun to beat people up and kill people, it's less fun than to love them, then I think women will emerge with greater power. And they will make better choices on the whole because they're more realistic. They bear the children. Actually, I will argue that women... You see, enlightenment has been wrongly defined as some brilliant thing that goes off in your head, like a light bulb goes, poof, enlightenment. And whereas if you bring in the compassion aspect, enlightenment actually means how sensitive you are to the wishes of others and how selfless you are, rather than what a brilliant idea you have, is how well you react to the way other beings are. And so if that's the case, the female is more advanced biologically toward enlightenment than the male. Which male is ready to have, you know, an immigrant in their belly, who they don't even have a passport or a visa, and they don't know if it's a male or a female or what? They don't know whether in the previous life were they a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a secularist. They have no idea, and it's suddenly there. And they give it free lodging, no rent, no tax, and then they have to get it out of there, which is quite a job. And then they have to nurse it and feed it from their own body. And there's a lot of compassion instruction in that. And the man, which man is ready to do that? So I'm saying the women on the planet now have to rise up, like His Holiness said. They have to tell the men, no, you don't have to conquer this other country before breakfast. You have to be cool and be nice to them, and it's more fun that way, etc., etc., you know? And I think that is happening. And there's a resistance, of course. And they're well, let's have a new round of nuclear weapons. Let's do this, let's do that. These guys who need better therapy, they need better sensitivity training. But they're too accustomed to violence and dominating by force. So it's taking time. But it will inevitably triumph, I believe. And in the Tibetan Buddhist, Indian and Tibetan Buddhist and Mongolian Buddhist setting, the prophecy about Shambhala is, I think, very positive and accurate, except I think it's already happening right now. I don't think we have to wait, but for that I have a difference with some scholarly friends. But I think it's already taking place now, and it's a consciousness battle. It isn't a military battle. And the consciousness battle is the choice of nonviolence and the choice of joy and happiness and bliss, versus the choice of power and domination and violence. And the choice of power and domination and violence is self-destroying, in my belief. But it takes people with it, is the trouble. It takes people with it. And but those people, even death, listen, death, you get reborn. If you die happy, you'll be reborn happy. So if you die angry, you're in danger. You'll be reborn in a violent form, because anger always wants to have armor and weapons and violence. So the key is happiness. And Buddha Dharma has the best education for happiness that fits with the happiness education available in other religious traditions, actually, because they all are working on that too. But as His Holiness would say, but you know, they may have more or less sophisticated psychology to go with it. And Buddhism has the great mind science, the great karmic biology science, and the great emptiness and relativity physics. Best of all, as a science. And this will help us, I think. That's my personal confidence. And if they come and shoot me, I'll try to stay happy if I can. You know, I wouldn't mind as long as they make an accurate shot. I don't like pain either. I'm a scaredy cat too. So, but that's my view. And I'm looking forward to visiting Buryatia, Tibet, Tuva, Mongolia, Moscow, Beijing, with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And when he is celebrated, when all of these people realize he's the leader of the leaders, he gives them the best advice of how to see a way through without violence. He's the Gandhi, living Gandhi, you know. He really is. And they will listen. They have to, I think. You know, Dzongkhapa, in his five, six-year retreat, he had, the only sutra he had was the flower ornament. because Nagarjuna is really teaching from Prajnaparamita, you know, transcendent wisdom. So he, that's equally important. I'm not saying this and that one. They're, each one is completely important in its own context. But I'm just saying the positive vision of the beauty of the world and the beauty of the power of the loving, enlightened beings is so well and beautifully presented in the Flower Ornament Sutra. It really is the revealing of Buddha's heart. You know, in the Chinese tradition, they say that, remember when Buddha attained enlightenment, he stayed in the grove there for 49 days. But in the Avatamsaka, they say that in that 49 days, he visited all different heavenly planes where there are different deities, gods. And he taught on each of the different desire realm heavens and in the form realm heavens, you know, 16 heavens. And he taught different stages there. And he already taught his mother, you know, Maya Devi and everybody. And it's he turned the whole place into one giant, huge Buddha festival for 49 days. And then he went out to deal with India in that present context and taught that thing. So Avatamsaka Sutra is like a giant exoteric mandala that shows, that gets the imagination used to the positive vision of life, which is something we're very deprived of in our cultures. The cultures do not encourage positive vision of life because they will encourage authority. You have to obey orders. You have to work in the factory. You have to do this, and you can have a little entertainment on Saturday night, and you can go to church on Sunday, but you can't have happiness because you have to work. Whereas that shows that the universe is just filled with joy and beauty, the Avatamsaka Sutra. So it's a very good antidote, you know, and that's why Tsongkhapa did it. In Tibetan culture, in the Samye Monastery, the first monastery, when you go around in the inner kora, inside, and you have to have flashlight because it's very dark, but you can still see the old paintings that are very ruined, but you can still see. And they are illustrating the scenes from the Avatamsaka Flower Ornament Sutra. So that's at the very beginning of the vision of Tibetan culture. You know, people get so serious about religion, and Buddhism has to be bad, so we have to obey something, and they want to follow some orders. But Buddhism is trying to, Buddha's whole revolution is that, you know, the human being is supposed to find their own inner bliss, nirvana. That's, he's announced nirvana, you know, bing, 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 like a commercial, like nirvana, here it is. That was what Buddha did. So the whole movement is based on the human beings realizing the greatness of their human opportunity and the beautiful planet available for them on which to discover reality and become Buddhas themselves. This is what our purpose of life is, and the opportunity that we have and our equipment to be able to do it of our incredible intelligence. And that's what Buddha wanted us to know. And among the 1,000 Buddhas of this aeon, Shakyamuni Buddha was praised by the other 996 of them, that 99 of them, that he picked this planet during its most difficult, you know, military violence-dominated time. At other times, when Maitreya comes and others, they say that people will be naturally more peaceful. It'll be easier. There'll be more schools, more Dharma schools and things. But he picked a particularly hard time and was born in warrior class, to be general, you know, conqueror, king. Remember, the father wanted him to be conqueror. So Avatamsaka Flower Ornament is just fantastic. And Buddha really liked it. And Tsongkhapa really liked it too. And you know, Tibetan culture that His Holiness talks about all the time, which he gave me as my job to try to work on, helping preserve, is, and the Mongolian culture too, related to that. And Indian culture too, though completely smothered there for a long time by conquerors. But it is a joyful thing. It's based on people don't choose to give up their empire and their weapons unless there's more fun being peaceful and more joy. Because people like to have fun, I think. I don't know if there's somebody here who hates fun. There might be some, but everybody likes it. And monks have fun saying their mantras. They're not in there going being miserable. They say their mantras and they have fun about it. They do.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded December 2018 during Professor Thurman's trip to Russia. To enjoy the full video version of this talk, please look in the podcast description. Will include the link to the extended hour-and-a-half teaching presented in English to a Russian-speaking audience of those in attendance for teachings about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including invites to special VIP events at New York City's Carnegie Hall, at Tibet House U.S., and at Menla Mountain Retreat in Benicia, New York, please visit tibethouse.us. Your tax-deductible donations help support the Tibet House mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture in the West. If you cannot donate, please be sure to share, comment, and like, and subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Every share, like, and comment helps support this podcast. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzing Chogyal, including his new album with Laurie Anderson and Jesse Paris Smith, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which concludes with a reading of poetry by our dear friend, Gary Gock. Thanks for tuning in, and hope to see you next week. Tashi Dedek.
Manjushri means, Shri means glory, glorious, and Manju means gentle. So gentle glory, what does that mean? Gentle glory is your own self, your own intelligence. Inside your own mind is the ability to understand something new that you didn't think you could understand. So they say inner Manjushri is your own wisdom and intelligence. Somewhere you're going to go, like that, I didn't know that. And it's a kind of wonderful feeling inside that your world changes because you have a new sense of what it is, of what its reality is. You become open to this thing. That's your inner Manjushri. Outer Manjushri is this you know, guy with it has a sword of wisdom, of intelligence, and a book of transcendent wisdom. That's the inner Manjushri. And he can have a female form also, known as Saraswati, who is the goddess of art, actually. And she's like female Manjushri, Saraswati, the flowing one. She's wonderful. Tsongkhapa had a special relationship with Saraswati from his youth, actually. And so his writings are always inspired by Saraswati. She's the goddess of poets. And then Avalokiteshvara is the... Ishvara means God, actually. And in Hindu, in Vedic, ancient Indian monotheism, Maha Ishvara, the great God, is their idea of a creator God. So the Buddhist name of Avalokiteshvara takes the word for God and then puts the word Avalokita on it. And Avalokita means who looks down with loving care on the fate of sensitive beings. Sentient means sensitive. So it's almost like it's a critique. It's a little hint of a critique of the old fearful idea of God as a punisher, you know, creator and controller and a harsh. You know, the Vedic gods were somewhat harsh in ancient India. Indra and company, they were like warriors, you know, because it was a warrior culture. And Buddha, remember, was born to be a warrior, but he rebelled against being a warrior. And instead he became a monk, a mendicant. Instead of being a warrior, he became an inner warrior, let's say. So Avalokiteshvara means God who cares for everybody. Every single feels their feelings, wants them to be happy, doesn't want them to suffer. So he becomes the God of compassion. And he even, always a bodhisattva means, but he actually is a Buddha. He is the compassion of all Buddhas. That's His Holiness's reincarnation. But, and there are also many other reincarnations of Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri. And your own inner Avalokiteshvara yourself is your own love and compassion. Because you all have love and compassion. You're a human being. If you didn't have love and compassion in your heart, you'd be a crocodile. And even crocodile has some love and compassion. But they have a really hard skin, you know. You can't really caress a crocodile. You know, they like claws and skin, and they're terrible. But they have compassion still. Especially the female crocodile, she has compassion. So Tantra is where Buddha creates an imaginative archetype and shares that with you. With people who have the ability not to get fixated about it, because they're more open-minded, you know. They've already used the teachings of selflessness and emptiness to liberate themselves from rigid identity habits. And they're sort of open to being this and that, you know. They have more awareness of their own inner resilience. And so it's safe for them to practice trying on being something divine, being something more magnificent than they used to feel they are being. Like you can imagine yourself being a Manjushri, you can imagine yourself being Avalokiteshvara or Tara or Saraswati or whatever it may be. And then by doing that, you can become more confident of your ability to understand and more confident of your ability to heal and to help others and more careful. You know, Avalokiteshvara has 1,000 arms. You know, one form, there are different forms, but the one form has 1,000 arms, which are said to be the 1,000 arms of the wheel-turning monarchs. That means good politicians, 1,000 of them. It's an Indian concept of a good king, like a Chakravarti Raja, they call it. And so that means the power to help other beings, multiplied by 1,000, that a king has, but multiplied by 1,000, a good king. And then each arm has an eye in the palm of the hand, which is the wisdom of 1,000 Buddhas, where the help is a knowledgeable help. You are like the doctor who knows what the patient needs. You don't give the wrong medicine. You don't do the wrong thing, because you're actually aware of what the need of the patient is. That's why, you know, a great spiritual teacher, for example, has to be able to a little bit have a clairvoyance to know what the student is thinking, to be able to know what is the right teaching for the student. They don't need it just to, you know, be a fortune teller or something, but an enlightened being needs that to be able to be a good teacher for others, to know what they need. A person who doesn't really know what other beings need and who pretends to be a spiritual teacher of theirs is actually getting in trouble, because they're just giving some general thing and they don't really know if it helps or not. Just like a doctor who doesn't know what the medicine, but then pretends and dishes out the wrong kind of medicine and it actually hurts the patient. So it's a very serious thing to sign up to be someone's spiritual teacher. Really serious. And we all know what happens when that goes wrong, you know. That's why in Tantra they say you don't pick a guru to receive tantric initiation until you've observed the person for 12 years. And then they say the guru doesn't take a disciple until they've observed them for 12 years. So the problem nowadays is both will be dead, probably. So it'll never happen. So we have to have exams that happen more quickly. So that's really mainly what I wanted to say. And as a kind of footnote for your questions, and just one thing, there, I just want to mention one thing. I don't know if it's translated into Russian, but of course in Sanskrit and in Tibetan, there's a wonderful sutra called the Buddha Avatamsaka Sutra, which means the Buddha Garland Sutra. And a garland of Buddhas, that means like a flower garland, you know, like you can create in India or in Hawaii, they have flower garlands, but the flowers are made of Buddhas. So each atom in the flowers are all Buddhas. And it's a certain vision of the universe, and it's not Tantra, it's exoteric. And in English, we do have a translation by a wonderful translator from Chinese mostly, called Thomas Cleary, published as the Flower Ornament Sutra. And I don't know if any part of it has been translated into Russian or Latvian, but it would be good if it did, or if you read English, if you read in that sutra, it's just sometimes, it's this wonderful positive vision. For example, when Tsongkhapa went on his 5-year retreat, Jayadamrcha Tsongkhapa, in the 1392 to 1398, he was in a retreat for really 6 years. He had that sutra with him among his more technical, centrist Madhyamaka works. He had the Avatamsaka Sutra, and he read about the vision of that sutra. And I just want to mention it in that there's a vision there. Recently, I was reading to somebody, and when I sometimes look, it's a very long sutra, but I read one passage where this young man is meeting a female teacher, a kind of goddess, at a sort of advanced level of his journey. And then he has a vision, then she radiates a light which fills his body, and then this light does, and then he has a new vision and he sees her. And then he's amazed because he sees that this woman, whose name is Sarva Sattva Tranoja Shri, the glory of liberating all beings, that's her name. And she's one of 10 special deities, including the mother of Buddha, the former wife of the Buddha, all of the characters in the Buddha's life, you know, female ones. And he sees that she, in a sort of as an invisible presence to most people, is hovering over every single sentient being. Like right here in this room, that goddess would be invisibly present here individually over every single one of us. And she'd be looking at us and what do we need and what are we unhappy about, what are we happy about? And she would be thinking of what she could do to help us, to bless us, like an angel. Like everybody has this kind of angel with tremendous mental power, just looking right, sitting right with them. So the reason I mention it is just that in the Buddhist universe, I just want you to know this, because this is very counterintuitive of our modern sense of life. And especially in the current planet, where we're very worried about the future, the young people are very upset, you know, the politicians are a little difficult, etc. In general, I'm saying, I don't mean particularly the idiot that I have to deal with. But there is an angel with every single being, and not just the human beings, also dogs and cats, every kind of being. So the Buddhist worldview is that the good guys, the positive beings, the love beings, are more powerful and more present than the bad guys. Even though sometimes even we'll be killed by some accident or some bad guy, their beings will be taking care of us through the after death state, the between state, in the future life state, etc. It's a very, very positive. Buddhism is based on a ridiculously positive view of life and an incredibly positive view of human life in particular, your life, and of you. So since depression is a major concern in modern industrial, consumerist, militarist society, I just wanted to share that when you contact aspects of Tibetan culture, Mongolian culture, you're contacting a culture that was infused with a feeling of the goodness, the power of the goodness of the universe, more than the badness. And that's the reason that Indians and Tibetans and Mongolians, and to a lesser extent some areas of the East Asian cultures, that they became less violent and more respectful of women and more happy. And that's why they have like a prayer flags like this. The prayer flags are telling us, have more fun, okay?
Welcome to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm Gary Gock. Juan Felipe Herrera. Juan Felipe was born in Fowler in 1948. He's a poet, performer, writer, cartoonist, teacher, and activist, and author of several books. A poem that was published on the San Francisco buses, entitled Thich Nhat Hanh, I Step With You. Thich Nhat Hanh, I Step With You. Step, breathe. Step, breathe. Peace flickers at the end of the flame. You sit, you speak one word, yet the word is impossible. Rice brown, an eggplant, soup green, violet. Your mind still for peace. Decade upon decade, bowing, speaking, lifting the dead from your shoulders, our hands. This is how you walk. One step we walk with you. One step there. A breath as you go, as we go.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast, and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.